And good evening, everyone. I'm sorry for the little bit of a delay, but we are here and we are ready, and this should be a very interesting evening. I have nuclear physicist and author Thomas Campbell, and I really love having shows with Tom, mostly because, you know, we approach consciousness from completely different ways. Tom approaches consciousness from a very scientific basis, and you know, he has an unbelievable amount of available information that you can watch, and it's pretty incredible. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have your YouTube site on the profile page so that people can go to it, because there's 107 videos right now, which I think they switch quite a bit, but, you know, there is so much information on there, understanding, you know, what you do and where you're coming from. It's really fascinating. I think that a lot of people would probably relate a lot more. I mean, there's one thing to have an interview, but to see it and to watch your workshops, I mean, it's really amazing, and that you're doing all of this, you know, to better humanity, I think is just, you know, I think we're very blessed to have you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Lori. You might mention, for those who might be interested in that YouTube, that if you go to YouTube and do a search on TWCJR44, then that will get you to my site.
It will. But I will also have it on your profile with... I will put that on your profile so that people can get it easily.
Okay, good.
All right. So, this is it. We're talking about consciousness, and I think it's just an interesting concept, because, I mean, I approach consciousness from a very different perspective, but we kind of come in and meet, and it's like you're providing the bridge, and you're also providing, I guess, a way for people that may not come into it the same way. So, you know, a lot of people, because of your experience and where you came from, because you did a lot of work with the Monroe Institute, you have a wealth of knowledge around out-of-body experiences and, you know, different ways to understand consciousness. And that's what I think is so fascinating, that we have this ability to understand each other and the world from this perspective. So one of the things that you talk about is that consciousness is not objective, but it's subjective, and so it has to do with our experiences. And you quoted another scientist, Max Planck, which is, we're part of the mystery we're trying to solve, which I think is just great, and that, you know, we keep focusing on what's out there, because our whole life, our whole experience in this physical reality is what we're doing and what we're seeing outside of ourselves, and not so much, you know, coming within ourselves. So why don't you talk a little bit about that whole piece?
Okay, well, first of all, I come with kind of a dual perspective, because before I wrote my books that have to do with a scientific assessment of consciousness and the larger reality, and you know, what it's all about, the nature of reality, you know, paranormal and physics and all that stuff all wrapped up together, I spent, probably 6 or 7 years with Bob Monroe, setting up his laboratory. I ran into Bob before there was such a thing as the Monroe Institute. It was just Bob, and he was trying to set up a laboratory to study consciousness, and I happened to pop in on his life at about the time that he was looking for scientists to help man his lab. So kind of got there off on the ground floor with Bob, and spent, let's say, at least a half a decade seeing old Bob probably about 20 hours a week studying consciousness, him teaching myself and Dennis Menerick, another person, and there were others involved as well, how to do out-of-body, with the idea that then we could study it and make science out of it. Bob really wanted to get this kind of, put it on the map in a scientific way. so he could be legitimate rather than just kind of the crazy old guy that had funny things happen to him. He really wanted this to be a science, something that he could teach others, something that could be shared, and that's why he started this Monroe Labs. So I started there, and I was a physicist just out of graduate school at the time, so young and ready to do anything, and found this very, very interesting concept. So that's how I got started. So I started from the, probably you'd say, the metaphysical side, where my experience was learning to go out of body whenever I wanted to, kind of on demand, and do things, and go to the past, and go to the future, and, you know, help people who were transitioning from this physical life to, you know, through death to an afterlife, and just healing, and we just played and did all sorts of things, remote viewing, and so I kind of had a lot of that sort of thing. But being a scientist, I've always wanted to put it all together. How does it work? You know, what's the causality in the larger reality? What can you do there? What can't you do? And why? What's it for? You know, how's it put together? Where does it come from? So as a scientist, those were all the questions that I wanted to answer. And after about, probably 30 years or so of practicing these things and experimenting with them and going into the larger reality and doing experiments there to find out how it worked and what its causality was, then I ended up writing these books. It was a trilogy called My Big Toe. And that was kind of the summary of all of this experimentation, really, that I was doing in the larger reality, and how did it connect to this reality, and what did it have to do with us. So then I've got kind of both sides of it. So I have the metaphysical side, I've seen auras for probably 30 years. I do those sorts of things. And at the same time, now I have a complete theory. And it was kind of neat with this theory of everything. It, you might reduce that to say it's a theory of consciousness, because everything is consciousness. You know, consciousness is the one thing that's fundamental. Everything else is virtual. So these books called My Big Toe, toe stands for theory of everything, and the idea was that if this logical, scientific story that I put together will explain better physics, it'll explain things that physicists now don't understand very well, and it derives both relativity and quantum mechanics, and it solves some problems in Princeton Pear Labs, where they have mind influencing matter, and, you know, things like the placebo effect that's been around for a long time. All those things now are very scientifically explained with this theory. So it kind of comes from both directions, both the direction that you're familiar with, which is kind of the spiritual, metaphysical, experiential direction, and that really came first, and then the scientific understanding of how it all works came later. So it's a big toe. I call it big because it has to explain the physical as well as the non-physical, normal as well as paranormal. It has to explain everything, the subjective and the objective. And as it turns out, our reality is not anything at all like most people, you know, think it is. And we think, scientists in general, I should say traditional scientists, think that this reality is objective. And matter of fact, the scientific method has an underlying implicit assumption that reality is objective. Because only if it is objective can you have this idea where you do the experiment and then you have other people have to be able to repeat the experiment and so on. And that only works in an objective reality. But our reality is probabilistic and statistical. And it only appears to be objective under special conditions. And then it approaches, or you can say approximates, being objective. And that's where the rule set that that this virtual reality plays by, it's when that rule set has very little uncertainty. In other words, you let go of a ball in the air and you know what's going to happen. It'll drop down. It won't fly up, you know. So the rule set, you know, gravity is part of that rule set. And there's very little uncertainty about how that works. So that's part of what, kind of our science, if you will, the hard sciences, are dealing with how does the rule set work, and there's not a whole lot of uncertainty based in that. It's basically mathematics and logic. But then you go into the softer sciences instead of the hard sciences, like sociology and psychology and those sorts of things, and suddenly there's lots of uncertainty. There's, those soft sciences is where they realized that experiments had to be done double blind. You know, physicists don't normally do double blind and that sort of thing because they're working with machines and equipment, and if a Geiger counter detects a particle now, it's going to detect a particle for anybody. It's not like you have to, do double blind. It just doesn't make sense. But in the social sciences, where there's a lot of uncertainty, they realize that a person's thoughts, a person's intent, a person's involvement, just like Max Planck said, a person's involvement actually changes the results. So they tell, they study this, and they'll tell elementary school teachers that, gee, you have a class of brilliant kids. These are all the smart kids that we've put in your class. And sure enough, those kids do better in her class. And they tell an equivalent teacher, oh, you've got all the dumb kids, the slow kids. Try to do what you can with them. And, of course, the children don't do nearly as well in that class. And that's, of course, because we have already typed them. There's expectations set up. And just the teacher's expectations had a major effect on the results. And on it goes, where people realized that if you were going to do any kind of soft science research, it had to be double and triple blind, or it didn't mean anything, because just as Max Planck said, we are entangled with our reality. We modify our reality with our intent. And that's the, that kind of brings us up, I guess, to where you dropped the conversation on my side of the net. So does that cover the things you wanted me to cover?
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's really fascinating because, on the one hand, it's like we have this, we're so intricate in how our lives play out, and yet we have all of these things that affect how our life plays out. And, part of it has to do with our intention, and part of it has to do, this is where we get, I think, confused. And so this is where I'd like to sort of talk about, some of the things that I'm not sure whether this is where we get confused, but just some of the ideas that as I was going through your work, trying to, put them all into perspective. So we are absolutely a part of our own reality. It's like I did an interview last night with Mark Borax, who talked about this karmic theater and how, it's not a new theory, but it's, we're the sole, we're the main character on the theater. We're also all of the people around us, plus we're the audience. And so trying to bring that all together and understand that. So if we have these intentions, and if, because we set those expectations, like you say, when you brought the school into it, so you set out the intention that these kids are not, or the expectation that these kids are not, they're the smart ones, these are not the smart ones. That affects how the teacher treats them, which affects how they are, therefore, move through that class that specific year. We do the same things to our own life, only we do them in really kind of back-assed ways. I mean, we have our ego, we have our fear, and we have our beliefs, and that can impact how our life evolves. And yet, how do we, you mentioned, getting rid of the junk. How do we get rid of our ego, our fears, and our beliefs? I mean, part of our ego, obviously there's a positive aspect to our ego, but there's an incredible different part of our ego that, how do we work with that?
Okay, well, first of all, let me comment that it's not just related to the causal chain of teacher has an expectation, therefore the teacher acts in ways to influence the children and modify their expectations. That's kind of a causal thing. You expect, well, the teacher gets up there and doesn't use big words because these are the dumb kids, and
right.
Doesn't, reads very slowly because these are the dumb kids and things like that. So the teacher does things that then inhibit the growth of the children And the children get the idea from the teacher that, you know, this is going to be a very slow-moving class and so on. So that's the causal part. But there's more to it than just the causal part.
Right.
Just because the teacher has that expectation that these children are not as bright will cause those children to become not as bright. And it doesn't have, and that's outside of the fact of this causality of what she does and how she influences the children. Just her intent, just her thoughts, just her attitude will indeed affect the ability of these children to do their schoolwork.
Right.
And that's because there's a lot of uncertainty, particularly with children. It's uncertain exactly how bright they are or what they're going to know or how fast they'll learn, because these are elementary school children, and everybody knows who's had children of that age, you know, they change a whole lot, you know. One that's slow one year will be, you know, quick the next. So you really don't know. With all that uncertainty, if you have someone applying intent to the situation, thinking that these children are slow, it will actually help them become. It will actually encourage or nudge them, I guess is a word, to be slower. You know, you might say it'll actually lower their IQ a little bit. You know, it'll make them a little less aware. And it does that not just through the fact that she interacts with them, but just because she has that in her mind. So it's you know, we tend to make it into, because we're so used to being in the objective world, we look for an objective solution. Oh, I see. You know, it's what the teacher says and does. But the fact is, if she believed that, even if she said and did the exact same things that she did in the smart class, the kids still wouldn't do as well if she believed they were dumb and had this idea about them, if that was her intent in her mind. So it would make a difference anyway. It's not just what happens in the objective world. Now, that's not necessarily a great example, because, you know, it's kind of murky as to what causes what. You have several things going on there.
Right.
But there are other things, some of the Paralabs experiment, reverse causality,
right,
or retro causality sometimes it's called. And what this is that you would take a radioactive source, which will eliminate some particle or some gamma ray or something in a random direction, and set two Geiger counters, one on either side of it, equal distance away. Now, physics and statistics would tell you that if you let it go for a long time to reach Geiger counter, has hundreds of thousands of counts, they both should have the same number of counts, because it goes off, these particles go off from the random source, go off from the source randomly. So it's just as likely to hit one or the other, and after you've taken enough samples, the two should be very, very close. Well, they can take this data, not actually ever analyze the data, just set the Geiger counter in there and take the data. So now they've got data someplace on a computer that has these counts in each of the two Geiger counters. Now, before anybody ever looks at the data and sees exactly how many counts there are in each Geiger counter, they can give this data to people and let them use their intent, their focused intent, to make one Geiger counter have more or less counts than the other. And they find that they can repeat this. Now, of course, the Geiger counter is not going to come out with exactly the same, but if you did this 10 times, and 10 times you had somebody say that Geiger counter A is going to have a larger count, and all 10 times Geiger counter A has a larger count, now you've done something that's about, you know, one in a million. Because you've done something that, okay, there could be little differences, but now you've picked the difference being biased in one direction 10 times, 20 times, 50 times in a row. That's like flipping a coin 10 times, 20 times, 50 times in a row and always getting heads. You see, that's also a 50-50, you know, like being a little higher, a little lower. That's a, you know, that's a probability of one half when you're looking at these. It's like flipping a coin. So then the probabilities get very, very, very small that, you know, that you could have done this randomly, just by chance. You're just lucky that you happen to pick the right Geiger counter, you know, 10 times in a row. Not likely. Very unlikely. So it's the same sort of thing. Well, how do they do that? It's not that they're changing what happened at the Geiger counter. What happened there happened there. What they're doing is changing the results. Then when they go look at the data and see which Geiger counter had how many counts, there's a difference. It's biased because of the intent. And the way that works is that data is in the future. that data hasn't been looked at yet. And as long as it's in the future and has uncertainty about it, because there's a certain amount of uncertainty, they're not expected to be exactly the same. They're going to be a little different. And with that uncertainty then, within that amount of uncertainty, the mind can bias the experiment. And these sorts of things, these retrocausality experiments have been done in many different institutions, mostly by physics departments and sometimes by parapsychology departments. And it's well-known fact that people can affect the future with their mind. And the same works with the placebo effect, which means the doctor gives you a sugar pill and says, you know, this is a wonderful medicine that we've just discovered and it's going to cure your ailment. And about 35% of the people you tell that to, it actually cures their ailment.
Right.
Matter of fact, it's getting very hard for drug companies to beat the placebo effect. They have a real hard time because it's such a powerful effect. So we know that people can modify the future with their intent.
Right.
And this is just one part of how our reality is not objective, that is probabilistic. So the future isn't a done deal. It's a probability distribution about all the things that could possibly happen. Then in the present, our free will, we make choices, and that's what does happen. And everything that we could have done but didn't, that becomes the unactualized history, and it's still associated with all the probabilities of how things might have happened. So you have these databases, as you can think of them that way. Now, I'm just giving you metaphors. When I talk about databases and things, these are really metaphors to explain how it all works. It's not a good idea to take everything literally, because we're really talking about something that is, I guess a little out of our reach. We are consciousness, and you can't really see consciousness from an objective viewpoint until you get outside of it and look back at it. As long as we're inside the system, as Max Planck said, we're part of the system, it's hard for us to kind of look back at it. It's like looking back at yourself. You do that with bias. It's hard to do that objectively. So the future hasn't been done yet. It's just probabilistic possibilities, and you can modify those just like the teacher in the class. You can modify the probability that this class will be a bright class or a not so bright class based on your intent. It actually changes the performance of the class, just like the placebo changes the person's health. So this is a big change for most people to realize that reality is not objective, and that our intent, and this gets to where you left off, our intent is often driven by all sorts of things. It should be driven by love,
right.
But what it's mostly driven by is fear.
Right.
Fear being the opposite of love. And fear generates some other things. Fear is the father or the generator of ego. It's also the generator of belief. It's the generator of wants, needs, desires, expectations, all those sorts of things. And that tends to be what drives most people's intents. So we live in this very strange probabilistic world, and we have all these people with intents that are mainly self-focused. And what do we get? Well, we get a very self-focused world that is, kind of a challenge to live in. And we are what we are. So what we see in this reality, all of the crime and dislike and hate and misery that goes on every day, people hurting other people, people trying to take advantage of other people, this is how we are. This is a kind of an accurate representation of the quality of our collective consciousness. So as you can see, we have a long way to go yet.
But, yes,
that's what
do.
You have, what you see is what you get, is what you are, I guess, is the way to put it.
Right. So I guess because I come from more the, how can we help people understand their ego, their fear, their beliefs? How can we help people, change the life that they're in to assist them to move into entropy, which, of course, is a word I'm never going to use, but to move towards love, how... When people, like a lot of times, a lot of these are in their unconscious. They're not even necessarily consciously aware of how fear is leading their lives. And I mean, with the example of the school teacher, I mean, when you think about, you know, we're a product from our parents. So if our parents had the thought that maybe we weren't going to achieve our best, and, you know, depending on how, you know, because we get all sorts of conditions placed on love as we grow up, which is not obviously what we're talking about when we talk about love, but it's really fears. It's our fears. It's our beliefs. But if we have all of these things that are impacting, unconsciously impacting consciously, how do we move towards, you know, a different place? How do we make that step, or how do we create that bridge that allow us to come from that space of love, which is, you know, the community and the support, and we're so unconscious.
A place to start in answering that question, you know, how do we get there? You know, how do we as a collective, how do we as a culture and as a planet full of people, how do we get to this point where love is what we're about?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you cannot change anyone except yourself.
Yes.
You cannot force or push change or understanding or awareness on anyone. All of that has to be done from the inside out, not the outside in. So that kind of leaves us then with the conclusion that if you'd like to help the whole make this transition to a more loving existence, the biggest thing that you can do is to make yourself transform to a more loving existence. If you can grow up, if you can decrease your entropy, increase the quality of your consciousness, become more spiritual, however you want to say that, grow toward love, all of these things I've just said are all kind of synonyms for each other. If you can grow up in this way, then you're actually helping others grow up. And it's not only by example. It's the same thing that we talked about before. The teachers can help the children to be smarter or dumber based on attitude. If your attitude is loving and caring, that'll help other beings have a loving and caring attitude. I think that's sometimes referred to as the 100th monkey effect. You know, people are connected to each other. We're all one thing. We're all part of the one larger consciousness system, which means we're all netted. We all can communicate, can share data, can share information. And, you know, I guess in kind of the New Age sense, you call it vibes. You know, you get good or bad vibes from somebody. But all that's true. We're communicating with the people around us, the people we know and our loved ones, not just when we talk to them or show body language, but we're communicating to these people all the time. And we also can communicate to the larger community, to our culture, you know, even to the world population. Depends on how we think, what we feel. So if you want to change the whole and make our whole world better, start with changing yourself and making yourself better. And the world will take care of itself. Now, as far as changing others, well, I've just said that you can't push a change. You can't make another person see something. You can't make them understand. You can't make them change. But you can do one thing that might help them, and that's besides just growing up yourself. And that is, you can help create an environment that makes it easier for them to grow up on their own. And that's typically an environment that's safe, that's secure, that's loving, that's caring. Because when you're in that environment, you can kind of stretch out and think bigger thoughts, do things that aren't just like what everybody else does, because you feel safe. Nobody's going to laugh at you. Nobody's going to, you know, give you a hard time. So by giving people loving, supportive environments, caring environments, we basically are optimizing their probability of becoming more spiritual, of growing up, of increasing the quality of their consciousness. So that's how that mechanism works. So what did a famous quote, you know, if you want to heal, you know, first heal yourself. You know, look at your own problems. Find your own fears. Now, the only antidote for fear that I know of is courage.
Hmm.
But first you have to find the fear. And we have all sorts of fears that we don't even know we have.
Right.
A lot of times when I'm giving a talk or something, I'll have some person, it's usually a young man, you know, somebody in his 20s that's male, and they come up to me and they say, well, you know, Tom, I don't have any beliefs and I don't have any fears. So, you know, what is it that I have to do? Well, of course, what they don't know is that they have lots of fears and lots of beliefs. They just don't know that they have them. These things are endemic. They come with our culture.
Yeah.
And that's your job then. That's everybody's job to find out, what are they? Why do we act like this? Why is it that we get angry? If we don't have fear, then why should we get angry? Why should we ever get upset? Why should things bother us? If we're just loving and caring, then by definition, whatever happens is good. Everything has an ability to help us grow, to help us react. Everything's a challenge that gives us opportunity. So there are no bad things to happen. Everything is good. Everything is an opportunity. We're not here to feel good, have a lot of money, acquire a lot of stuff. And that's not why we're here. We're here to grow up, to learn, to become love. And unfortunately, most of us won't change without pain.
Right.
We need pain as a motivation. If everything is going good in our life, we kind of lay back and hope that nothing changes. You know, this is good. But in fact, pain is the great motivator. So there's a lot of it in our society. It gets passed around all the time. And that's our lesson. That's feedback. We're causing that pain because we are not love. We're not where we should be, being what we should be. And another thing to mention, that this is not, this being, this growing up, this love is not at the intellectual level. It's not that you intellectually decide, okay, I'm love, I care about everybody, I love everybody, you know, peace, cheers, you know, sit down, cross your legs, do a few, ohms, and smile all the time. That's intellectual. That means you're doing it because you think you should, because it's right. That's different than doing it because that's just the way you are. It expresses you at the being level. So there's a real big difference between understanding things intellectually and actually being that way without benefit of the intellect. You're not thinking about it, you just are that way. So if you walk up and you help somebody and you're kind to someone, it's not because you think, well, it's good to be kind. That's kind of coming from the intellect, and it is good to be kind, but that doesn't make you kind. You're not kind until kind is just the way you are, and it's not a thinking about it, and it's not looking at the situation and say, well, I should do this. It's just doing it because that's the way you are. You don't need reasons. You just are. And when you get to that point, then life is fun. It's a joy. The pain goes away, and suddenly you find that everything is really nice and neat, and there's challenge everywhere, and it's exciting and fun, and it kind of changes your whole perspective. So that's kind of my advice on how do you get there.
Right.
You have to, one, find your fear. What is it, you know? Where does your ego come from? Why do you get upset and angry and nervous and depressed? And all these things have to do with fear. You know, why do you have expectations that things have to be a certain way? Other people have to be that way. You know, we're often that way with the people that we love, and our love is often conditional. Well, I'll love you as long as you do this for me. You know, our relationships tend to be based on need rather than based on love. I'll fulfill your needs if you fulfill my needs, and that's not what it's about. We call that love, but it's really something else. It's really mostly fear and expectations, trying to find a situation in which you feel good rather than trying to find a situation in which you can do something and be useful and helpful to somebody else. So does that kind of answer the question a little?
It does. I mean, it's funny because we have a lot of things that are unconscious, and you know what we have to do is to continue at it so that we create them to become more conscious. And it becomes, I mean, I think we've talked about this before. I mean, we're really at the beginning stages of consciousness, so we have so much. I mean, we have so much to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's for sure. I tell people that this this reality we're in. I call it a physical matter reality. In my books, that's a PMR, physical matter reality. And I tell people that its function, its purpose is to be a learning lab. It's a digital trainer, if you will, for evolving quality of your consciousness. So that's what we're here for, and that's what this reality is all about. But don't think that we're in graduate school. You know, we're in elementary school here in this learning lab, maybe even preschool.
Yeah.
We're not a bunch of advanced beings when it comes to love, as, you know, any look at the television or, you know, newspaper will tell you. You know, we're at the very beginning levels, and that's why it's such a challenging place.
Right. And I think, you know, I want to touch on this because this is some of the work that I do, but it seems like you talk about metaphors. So you talk about, you know, the higher beings as metaphors. There's a lot of things out there right now where, you know, we feel, I guess a lot of people are feeling, our ego wants to be in control. That's the big thing, is that we're always in need of something. We're always in a state of fear because we're trying to be in control of our lives, and we'll never be in control. But then it brings up the concept of, well, what is in control? Like, is there a higher body of us that sometimes sets contracts and things happen? I mean, it makes me think of the new movie that's come out, which is called The Adjustment Bureau, which is really, you know, these beings come in at certain points to try and tweak their destiny so that they move towards the contracts that they feel they should be doing. And you know, there's a lot of people, I mean, we see the good things as synchronicities when we move towards, you know, something that helps us evolve, but it's very confusing because there's a lot of people out there, and of course there's a lot of people out there that believe in evil and, you know, a lot of darkness, and, you know, at what point, I mean, they're all metaphors of where we're at, whether we're in fear or whether we're in love. Like, is that what it's about?
Well, this idea of metaphors has to do with language.
Yeah.
We have to communicate with each other with words and language, and words are basically symbols and metaphors. They stand for something. You know, they're a symbol. They're a sound that stands for something, and it's a metaphor or a symbol. You know, metaphors and symbols are very similar things. Metaphors just tend to be a little more descriptive, I guess, but basically symbols and metaphors. So we tend to put everything into metaphors that we understand, that make sense to us. So we talk about our higher self, and we talk about our guides. And yes, indeed, there are those relationships. You can have that kind of relationship with a larger conscious system, a guide that helps you, that you converse with, that helps you grow and is a guide for you. And indeed, you know, you can interact with this higher self. But the guide and the higher self are just metaphors. They're not, they are real things, but they're metaphors. They're metaphors for us to be able to describe our interaction with the larger consciousness system in terms that we understand. So if we have a communication with this larger consciousness system, then we interpret that communication to be with a being, because what else could you communicate with? Right? You can't communicate with a rock. So we use, when we get that data, then we say, oh, that's a being. Well, we call it a being because we get data from it. Well, that's what we all are. This is a digital consciousness reality system. And what we are is chunks of consciousness, and we communicate by sending data back and forth. Okay, so that's kind of how we are, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're all separate. You see, we're all one thing. We're all part of this big consciousness system. So when you need a little help and you start to call up your guides, well, this larger consciousness system just bubbles up a guide. And because you've done this many times, it bubbles up a guide you know, that interact with you the way you're used to interacting. So think of a guide, say, as your interface, your personal interface with the larger consciousness system. It's not like there's this being out there just, you know, sitting on a cloud, hanging around, waiting for you to ask. You know, it'd be a pretty boring life. You just sit around and, you know, I'm Lori's guide, and I just have to kind of hang out until she says, guide, you know, I need some help here. And then I go, oh, okay, gee, master calls. But it's not like that. It's just your interface with a larger consciousness system. So we're really all one thing. And when we incarnate, it's the same thing. It's not that we are individual selves so much as it is that we have a history. And when it's time for us to jump back into the learning lab, well, larger consciousness, we bubble up right out of it and do that. And we return right back to it. So if you see that, we all are of the same thing. We're all, you know, bits and pieces of this digital information system that bubble up out of the system and return to the system, all one. So that kind of gives a bigger perspective of how we relate. That's why we all can communicate. We're all part of the same thing. We're all in the same net, if you like, all part of this larger system. And the larger system itself is trying to evolve. It's not a done deal either. It's still evolving, and we are part of its strategy to evolve. As we evolve, it evolves. So that's kind of a little slice of the big picture there. I know your listeners are going to be very confused because, you know, it takes me like 900 pages to get all this out, you know, in the books. And now I'm just popping off the top of my head, you know, kind of stating the conclusion without any of the derivation. So it's going to sound kind of strange, I guess, but there really is a logical scientific derivation behind it.
And there is, and I definitely encourage people to go to his YouTube and take advantage of all of this wealth of knowledge. But okay, so if we connect in with the higher aspects that allow us to evolve, and the people that, you know, are so adamant that there is evil around, and that, you know, there are people that step in to try and control things for them, then that is because that's where their evolution is at, because they are de-evolving or they're still stuck in fear and can't see love? I mean, is that part of the problem?
Yeah, yes. You see, your beliefs limit you to what you can experience, because if you believe that things are a certain way, then that's kind of the way they are for you. So, yes, you get in what I call the belief trap. You get into these traps, and it's very hard to get out. You have to, my little metaphor is pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You know, you have to do that, and you can do that just very slowly. But you're right. Control is our issue. You know, we want to control everything. We want to control things to make sure that they kind of happen the way we think they should. You know, that even if it's our children, we want them to, you know, to go to college and get smart and get a good job and find a good mate, and we, you know, we'll control things to help them do that. What do they need to do that? Well, they, you know, they need good grades. So we'll try to control as we can to get them to do their homework, and we control everything, and we control each other and our relationships, husbands and wives and girlfriends and so on. They are very controlling relationships, and not in a sense that one's trying to dominate the other. That happens too, but just control. Everyone's trying to make sure that things happen the way they'd like to see them happen for themselves and for others. But what you find out is that when you give up control, when you just let it go and say, yeah, I don't have any control, I don't want any control, I just live. I live in the moment, I interact with whatever happens, I deal with it when it happens, and I don't control anything. You'll find out that actually gives you a lot of control. Because when you live that way, things just come to you as you need them. It's almost like, in economics, they have the just-in-time manufacturing. Well, it works that way. When you give up that control, suddenly the things that you need, the things that are the great lessons for you, and everything just falls into place. Everything is there, and so suddenly, without any control at all, you've achieved that goal of having everything the way you want it. And you don't have to do anything. It just is, because that's the way the consciousness system is. Everything is there for you to learn. And if what you want to do is want to learn, then it's all there just the way you want it. So it's this control thing is very interesting. I think you found that too. The less you try to control things, the less you have to control things. Everything just tends to work out.
Mm-hmm. It brings us up to, again, free will and trying to understand because, you know, is it because we feel that there or believe that there are things that will control us and manipulate us because of our experiences that we feel we don't have free will sometimes? Or, you know, is it that aspect that keeps happening to us that because of our experience it creates a belief that therefore, you know, makes us feel like we don't have choices, we don't have free will, things just happen to us?
Yeah, people don't really understand free will. Free will is not, you know, when you say we have free will, that doesn't mean we get whatever we want. Free will basically says that you have choices. At any particular moment, you have choices. And it doesn't matter. If you're in prison, you still have choices. One of them is not to walk out the door. That's one of the choices you don't have in prison. But you have lots of other choices. All of us have choices. Choices how to respond to something. Choices how to feel. Choices how to react. Choices how to be, how to think. All the choices. We get thousands of choices in a day, and we can decide what to do with each one of those choices. Now, I call that all those choices we have that we know about, I call that our decision space. That's kind of the space, the area in which we can make decisions. But, you know, that's not all of the decision space that's available to us. That's just all we know about. A lot of people have many choices they don't know they have. Matter of fact, that tends to be the real problem with suicide. People who are contemplating suicide feel like they have no choices. You know, there's no way out. There's nothing else they can do but end it all. You know, they feel dead-ended, locked in, trapped. And that's because they don't see choices. Their decision space is very, very tiny, even though there may be lots of choices that they can make. They just don't see them. So they have a little tiny decision space, and that means their reality is shrinking. They have little tiny realities. We create our own reality. If you have a big decision space, you have a large reality, and vice versa. A little decision space is a little reality. And within that decision space, you have free will. You can make good decisions or bad decisions. Now, you may get into habits where, you know, you always act this way because that's the way you always act. That's just a habit. But it doesn't mean that you couldn't react differently. You could react differently. You're not trapped. That's just a belief. That's an expectation. That's ego. And that's the whole point. You get rid of all that stuff. And as you get rid of all that, then your decision space grows, your reality grows, and your abilities to work and deal within that reality growth, you become love. So the control thing and the free will thing are kind of connected. We try to control, and we feel like we can't control, and therefore we feel like we don't have free will. But free will is not about control. It's about the decisions. So if someone comes up and says something rude to you, somebody cuts you off in traffic, and you have a choice of how to react. You can give them the finger and swear and, you know, shake your fist and holler and beep your horn. That's a decision you can make. Or you can say, gee, I'm sorry, guy, you must be full of fear and anxiety here. I hope you feel better, and just go on your way. Those are choices you have. And that's how you learn. That's how you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, is you look at every little tiny choice you have every minute of every day, and you make each one of them toward love, toward being and caring for others, and you let go of the ones that are about, you know, what can I get, and what about me? You let those go. So it's by making those choices. Now, consciousness, the existence of consciousness, and the existence of free will are a set. You cannot have consciousness without free will. Consciousness becomes illogical if you don't have free will. Free will is illogical if you don't have consciousness. Those two things are what they say logically necessary for each other. So if we're conscious and if we have consciousness, then we have free will. Now, we may not do much with it. We may be suicidal and have a tiny little reality and a tiny little decision space, but we still have a finite decision space. There's no point where you have no decisions that you can make. It just gets to where you don't see many of the decisions that you have to make. We all have free will. Mostly we squander it by trying to manipulate other people to be the way we want, but that's not necessary. So free will isn't getting what you want. Free will is making the decisions that you can make, that you know about, and making them count.
Perfect. Okay, so I want to end with one thought, but I'm definitely going to have you back, because this we could probably talk for days.
Days, yes. Probably, maybe even weeks. Yeah. That would be interesting, a week-long radio program.
It would be interesting. I want to bring it back, and I know we touched on this before, but the law of attraction. So, because you talk about Dr. Emoto's work where he put a thought to water crystals and how that intention again, so we get back to what our intention is. So the law of attraction, the actual movie, was, I'm sorry, but it was very much ego-based. It was very much about greed. It was all about, you know, what can I create for myself that's wonderful and amazing and absolutely, you know, what we need. And so it's not about, you know, attracting more money and attracting the bigger house or attracting the perfect spouse or even health and well-being, except if we bring it towards our evolution. So if we can somehow create our intention towards evolution, does that assist in, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, if it is about greed and if it is about our ego, then what we'll get is big lessons.
Yeah, the system still works. You know, that's just the way consciousness works. You can modify the future. And if what you want is a new Mercedes-Benz and you just spend lots and lots of time thinking about it and put a lot of intent to it, what you'll do, you don't necessarily get a new Mercedes-Benz, but you will raise the probability that you will get one. And if you raise it enough, you know, then you probably come by one. So that does work, because that's how, you know, placebo effect works. That's how all these things work, is we can modify our probable future with our intent. That's part of the feedback in this learning laboratory, is that you get this feedback. You create your reality. So if your reality sucks, it's because, you know, you're not doing things right. If your reality is joyful and fun and pleasant, then you probably are doing things right. So that's part of this feedback. Your intent tends to create the reality that you're worthy of, if you will, the reality that you deserve. You know, you create that. So yes, it is true. You can use it for ego things, but beware. If you do that, you're likely, the system, you're asking the system to really work against itself. The system is trying to help you evolve. That means let go of ego. And if you use the system to aggrandize your ego, now you're asking the system to work against itself, and you may get what you want, but you will probably also get a lesson that will teach you something about ego, and it probably won't be pleasant. So that's, you know, it's not a good thing. You're right. You can do that, but what a waste of your time to do that. I mean, who cares about a new Mercedes-Benz? I mean, what value does that have in raising the quality of your consciousness or becoming love? You see, it's irrelevant. It makes no difference. So, you know, it kind of brings us to a little parable. I think I read it in a book of, I think it was maybe Sufi Tales. And it always struck me as being a very interesting and informative story. You know, a guru and his followers, you know, were talking about the guru's guru, you know, the master's master. And he said that, okay, he would take his followers to see his master one day and introduce them. And he did that. And when he did, he walked up to this lavish mansion. And his master was not the servant, but the owner. And he had servants and he had all sorts of things. And his student said, "What is this? How can your master be this person with all this stuff? I mean, we live out of wood bowls, you know, we walk around, we shave our heads, you know, we live a subsistence life." And the answer was that we live this way because that's what we need to grow. Because if we had other things, our egos would, you know, kind of take charge, and we would no longer grow. But if you don't, if those things don't mean anything to you, if those things are not, you know, possessions and stuff that you have to have, if it's just there, then there's no reason that you can't have that. It's just that it depends on how you look at it. If it's an acquisition, if it's ego-based, if it's mine, and now I got this, then it's not good. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, having a Mercedes-Benz. You know, that's not an evil thing that one should you know, avoid. What one should avoid is an ego and desire and wants that are not based in love. So that's the, you know, that's a real good point that you bring up. It's not the stuff. It's not the act. It's the intent of the act. So it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter about any of the stuff, any of the things. What matters is who you are inside. What's the quality of your consciousness? That's what matters. And if you use these kinds of tricks, like the law of attraction, in order to aggrandize your ego, you're de-evolving. You're going backwards, not forwards. And you pay a price for that. Your reality will shrink. You will have problems. You will get pain, because pain is the result of that sort of thing. So that's kind of the way it works. Yes, it's true. You know, it's like prayer. There is value in prayer. Prayer isn't just a meaningless act. People pray, and they're putting intent into something. And just like the law of, you know, of attraction, it's not really attraction. You're not attracting things from the universe. You're modifying the probabilities of the future. You can do that with meditation. You can do it, with prayer. You can, however. But intent is the key. Consciousness follows our intent.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, because there's so many people that are in this field where it's about service, but, you know, it's not so much. I mean, there's still such an ego trip to it. I mean, it's still about, you know, serving your own needs in a way. Like, it's really hard to get out of that state of...
Oh, it is. I mean, you'll see people arguing over which one of them is more loving, right?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. It's like that. We're in an elementary school, and, everybody is doing the best they can with, you know, what they've got. We're all here evolving. We're all at different levels in this evolution, but most everybody is struggling to do the best they can with what they've got. And what you've got is basically where you left off last time. You know, it's how much you've been able to evolve the quality of your consciousness. So whatever you are, however you are, that's where you have to start. That's what you've got. And, you know, the struggle can kind of be a mean struggle and a painful struggle sometimes, but we're all doing it. So it's good never to look down. I mean, you look at other people, and they're full of ego, and they're full of hate, and they're petty, and they're all this stuff, but they're really doing the best they can with what they've got. You know, again, we're in an elementary school, daycare, and one needs to have compassion for people and realize that, we're on our own path, they're on their own path, we're struggling, they're struggling, and we're all a different place.
Yeah, I mean, it's really coming to that place, and the choices that we make, whether we're making a choice from fear or we're making a choice from love, and it's those choices that, you know, that's what we are in charge of. That's what we can affect.
That's it. That's what we're here for, to make those choices with a loving intent, and that's how we grow up. And the more you grow up, the more you become kind of aware of the larger system and a part of it. And pretty soon all the stuff that you hear about, all the paranormal stuff and all the stuff that, you know, that things come to you and serendipity and all that just happens. It just becomes part of your life. It's not that you have to go out and do it because you want power so you can control things. The way you end up with abilities is to just be love, and the abilities all come by themselves.
Yeah.
They're natural.
Well, Tom, it's been a great pleasure, as always. Tell people how they can get a hold of you. It's all on your profile, but tell them anyway.
Okay. You can, if what I said made any sense to you at all, popping right off the top like that without any background, then you can find out more about it if you go to my website, which is www.mybigtoe.com, or you can go to YouTube, look at the, you can search on TWCJR44, and there's all sorts of things there, right? I would suggest you start with the Hawaii seminar. There's 14 10-minute segments in that one, and then our questions come next, which were the questions people asked after the seminar, and then there's the experiential exercises. And the experiential exercises is where I teach people and explain to them, you know, how do you heal with your mind? How do you remote view? How do you go out of body? And what does it mean? And what are the things to do and not to do? And some understanding. It's not so much that I'm teaching people to do it, as I am teaching people to understand what it is and what it means and what the experience will be like and how to interact with it. So if you're interested in any of those things, then you can go there. There's also a very active forum. If you go to that webpage I mentioned, you can go to the discussion group, and there's a whole bunch of people every day that talk about these things, and that's really a great forum. A lot of very, very smart and talented and loving people come there. So if you're interested, those are the places to go. Thank you very much, Laurie.
And maybe next time we'll...
a little opportunity to, you know, to say that.
No, absolutely. Hopefully next time, you know, we'll kind of combine it a little bit more. But I had all these questions from, you know, just a little bit of what I understood, and so that's where we went. But I think it's really amazing what you do. So thank you, Tom, for all the work that you're doing.
You're very welcome. And how many of all those questions did you actually get to?
Yeah, not a few of them.
Yeah, I think we need a week.
Probably. All right. I'm making a promise right now that at least 3 shows a season. So maybe we'll even have you back before we end this season. Which, cross fingers.
That'd be fun. I always enjoy talking with you, Laurie. You're one of my favorite interviewers because you're just so delightful. you're so straightforward and so easy and so honest and real that it's always enjoyable to chat with you. So I'll come back as often as you like.
Great. Thank you, Tom.